Recording in progress.
Okay, so Bishar Tova.
You can start when you're ready. You can start when you're ready, Rebbe. We can. I'll edit out the beginning. No pressure.
Okay, we are back in the shiur business, Bishar Tova. And of course, the Parsha of Shoftim always inaugurates the month of Elul. And Elul is a magnet of sorts, as we know, for allusions, Roshei Tevos, Ani L'Dodi, V'Dodi Li, Ish L'Re'ehu, Matonis Le'Vyonim. There's a lot of Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed, and all of them, all rivers are heading towards the sea of Elul and giving us an insight, an orientation for these special period. But there is a remez that I was alerted to, actually, on Friday evening. I did not manage to track down the source itself, but it was cited for me as having been said over by Rav Moshe Shapira Zatzal, which means it's legitimate. And the remez is from the well-known pasuk that we say every day, Uva l'tzion goel, u'l'shave pesha v'yakov ne'um Hashem. That's Uva l'tzion. Where is Elul in these words? If you look again, Uva l'tzion goel, so goel, the final two letters are Aleph Lamed. And then the next word, Ulishave Pesha, the first two letters of Ulishave are Vav Lamed. So the Aleph Lamed of Goel and the Vav Lamed of Ulishave give you Elul. More than that, I wasn't told, as if to say, what is the significance and what is the meaning behind this? But I believe that one may say the following. Elul is an interesting time for other reasons. As we know, in the lead up to Tisha B'Av in the 3 weeks, so we have three haftaras of calamity, what are known as Tzlosa de Puranusa, the three of Puranus, of calamity. And then we have, following from Nachamu onwards, we have seven haftaras of comfort, known as the Shiva de Nechemta. And I believe many people, as far as the flow is concerned, are familiar with those two groups, the three of Poronos, and then the seven of comfort and consolation. And those, that's your special Haftaras. But interestingly, there is another set of Haftaras, which is mentioned in the same source. All of these come from the Psikta, which is a collection of Medrash, and the Psikta is cited by Tosos in the end of Maseches Moed Katan. And there, a third group is identified. We have used the three of Poronos before Tisha B'Av, the seven of comfort after Tisha B'Av, and then Tarti D'Tiyuvta. Two of Tiyuvta, Tshuva. Two Haftaras of Tshuva. What are the two Haftaras of Tshuva? So the Psikta says it is the Haftara of Dirshu on Tzom Gedalia afternoon, which is about Tshuva. And then also Shabbos Tshuva, Tshuva Yisrael. Interestingly, the Psikta doesn't deal with the Haftara of Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. But now we have the three groups, calamity, consolation, and tshuva. And once we have all three of them in front of us, there is room to ask a very simple question. We know, Rambam states, and it's based on the Gemara, that all the good things that we're looking forward to in the future are contingent upon the Jewish people doing tshuva. That is the simple reading of the Psukim in Parshas Nitzavim that we'll get to quite soon. Rambam says, Ein Yisrael nig'olin ela mitoch ha-tshuva. Tshuva is a prerequisite in order to bring all the good things about. If that's the case, and you have two haftaras of tshuva, it's very interesting that we seem to have inverted the order of the sequence here, of how things should be, in the sense that we start with per onus because that's how it all began. But in terms of how things will then get better, tshuva is the juncture. Tshuva is what actually brings about the change from per onus to nechama. So if that's the case, at the risk of asking a balabatisha question, perhaps the order should have been the three of calamity and then the two of tshuva, which are the catalyst for the seven of nechama. And how interesting it is that we don't do that. We talk about nechama and we talk about tshuva afterwards. Halo davarhu. It's a very interesting observation. And this question is addressed by one of the great Balei HaMusa of the previous generation, Reb Shlomo Bravda, is his name. Some of you may be familiar, he's American born. And in his Sefer Yemei Ratzon, he says something very interesting. In order for tshuva to work, one thing above all needs to be clear to the person, and that is that things can get better. Things can and will get better through tshuva. It's possible for a person on a personal level to reach a situation where they're not sure if they can ever better their situation. So they have this tool called tshuva, but how can they use it if they don't really have much confidence in it? They're certainly not going to optimize it, or perhaps even use it at all. And the same can be true for the Jewish people. The peronos of the Jewish people have been many and profound, which might lead the Jewish people to a state of national despair at some stage, as if to say, this is it, and to lose sight of a better future, of the ultimate geula, and so on. So if you talk to them about tshuva, it's falling on deaf ears, largely, because they're not interested in bettering their situation if they don't think that it really can get any better. To that end, as a prelude, and as a crucial prerequisite, an introduction to the times of tshuva, we don't even talk about tshuva for 7 weeks. All we talk about is nechama. The geula will come. Times will get better. The Jewish people will be restored to their former pride and glory, so will Yerushalayim, so will the land of Israel, and all good things will happen. Now, it's true. We need tshuva in order to make them happen. We'll talk about tshuva when we get there. Much more important to emphasize that the peronos were never the end result. They were never the desired goal. They were a necessary means, but the desired end is always that of geula. If that can get instilled into our system, and it does, over the course of these 7 weeks, now we can talk about tshuva, because we engage in tshuva as something that is clear to us, that can make a difference. So this is very interesting, because Elul is a kind of a blended time in this way. On the one hand, there is a notion that we're getting ready to do tshuva. There are turns in that direction, we start to hear the sound of the shofar, and we think of Elul as a month of preparation, whatever that preparation looks like, that may well be. But how very interesting it is to note that the envelope of the month, as far as the Haftarah is concerned, all you will hear for every single Shabbos during Elul is Nechama. Kumi Ori, Kiva Oreich, His ori, his nari, me afar kumi. That's all you hear. Because the encouragement to look towards the future is indispensable before you then set about the work of bringing that future about through our tshuva. So this was Rav Bravda's, I believe, very profound insight into the order of the Haftorahs, first Nechama, and then Tshuva. And I wonder, therefore, going back to our Remez, our Elul Remez, where we have the first two letters of Elul are in the word Goel. And then the second two, the Vav Lamed, are in Ulashavi Pesha. In a sense, that really sums up what we've been saying. The Pasuk itself is very interesting. The Pasuk talks about Geula, before it talks about tshuva. Uva l'tzion goel. The ge'ula will come. Now, is tshuva necessary? Absolutely, but it's mentioned second. First things first, ge'ula will come. Okay, now make it happen. Ula shavei pesha, because that's where things are headed. So the very atmosphere of Elul, which emphasizes encouragement before exhortation and consolation before tshuva, that itself is reflected in the beginning of Elul, is in Geula. And then it leads out into Ula Shavei Pesha. So these, I think, are wonderful sentiments to lift our spirits and encourage us to engage in these days and weeks that are coming, to fully maximize the Nechama that we know ultimately is on the way, and to use the tools at our disposal through tshuva and so on in order to bring that about. So these are some thoughts with regards to Elul, and now let us get down to Parshas Shoftim. Shoftim by name, Shoftim by nature. The opening section of Shoftim deals with the Sanhedrin, the setting up of a Sanhedrin, and certain protocols. And I'd like to take a look at a famous section, which is in Perek Yud Zayin. And it starts in Pasuk Ches. And briefly, the pasuk describes, if you have a question in halacha and you're not sure, you should go to the central Sanhedrin and talk about it with them, and they will issue instruction which you need to heed. So let us see in pasuk yud, perek yud zayin, pasuk yud, va'asisa al pi hadavar asher yagidu lacha min hamakom ahu, and then you need to act, says the Torah, you need to act based on, in accordance with what they tell you from that place, asher yivchar Hashem, that Hashem will choose, v'shamarta la'asos kechol asher yirucha, and be sure, see to it and guard carefully that you do everything that they instruct you to do. And pasuk yud aleph continues, pasuk yud aleph of perek yud zayin, al pi haTorah asher yirucha, based on the Torah that they teach you, and also the judgment that they tell you, you shall do. Lo sasur, do not swerve min hadavar asher yagidu lecha, from the thing that they tell you, yamin usmal. So these two psukim lay out in quite a detailed way, in fact, the requirement to heed the words of the Sanhedrin in what they say, and in fact, the words that we just read actually contain two of the 613 mitzvahs, because it begins by saying ve'asisa al pi hadavar asher yagidu lecha, which is a positive commandment. You shall act in accordance with what they say, and then the famous lo sasur, do not swerve, do not depart from what they say, is a lo sase. So this is lo sasur. To listen to the Sanhedrin and not to deviate from those words. The crucial question that needs to be addressed here is which words specifically of the Sanhedrin are included in these mitzvahs? And in order to understand the question, let us preface with the type of things that the Sanhedrin will deal with. Because actually, they deal with three areas of instruction. And our question will be, how many of those three areas are part of what the Torah is talking about when the Torah itself instructs you to listen to the Chacham? What are these three areas? The Rambam lists them. In the Sefer HaMitzvos, of course, discussing the mitzvah of Lo Sasur, and also in the beginning of Hilchos Mamrim in the Mishnah Torah. Firstly, says Rambam, they are the transmitters of Torah traditions from way back when. Every generation transmits them to the next generation. So that's transmitting information. That's area number one, about the mitzvahs. Area number two, they will need to paskin concerning the mitzvahs. And that's how it all began. You have a shayla, you're not sure. Is this mutter on Shabbos or osser on Shabbos? And so on and so forth. Is this kosher, is this not kosher? All of these relate to Torah matters, and the question has arisen, and the Beis Din needs to arbiter and render judgment in this d'oraisa matter. Is this mutter or aser on Shabbos? And so on. That's the second area, and that may take the form of darshaning psukim. And when they darshan psukim, those drushas are have themselves the force of dinda arisa, the expositions on the psukim. But there is a third area that is in the purvey of the Sanhedrin, and that is to institute enactments, some positive and some preventative, muktza and all the rabbinic fences that protect against violating an Isser Torah. They're what we call derabbanan, because they're from the Rabbanan. And now the question is, how many of the above three, if we just summarize them so they're completely clear? Number one, transmitting Torah information from previous generations. Number two, expounding psukim to resolve new situations. And number three, rabbinic enactments. How many of those three are included in what the Torah is talking about when it says, instructs you to follow the Sanhedrin and not to deviate from those words? Says the Rambam, famously, all three. Both the words of the Rabbanan about the Araisa matters, transmitting information and darshanim sukkim, and also the words of the Rabbanan that are protective in nature, or enactments, or fences and measures, are also included in the Torah's mitzvahs. And in fact, the Rambam describes this from within the psukim that we just read. Because actually, go back to Pasuk Yud Aleph. Pasuk Yud Aleph describes three communications from the Sanhedrin. It reads, Al pi ha-Torah asher yaruchah. That's number one, the Torah that they teach you. Number two, Val ha-Mishpat asher yomer lecha ta'aseh, the judgment that they render. And then it says, Lo sasur, do not swerve, min hadavar asher yagidu lecha, the matter that they teach you. So we have the Torah they teach you, the Mishpat they teach you, the davar that they tell you. The Pasuk has specified three areas, says Rambam in the beginning of Hilchas Mamrim. Hareyu Omer, Al pi ha-Torah asher yarucha, that's the first phrase that we quote, that we read from this Pasuk. Eilu ha-Gezeres va-Takonos, that's the protective measures and enactments, v'amin hogos. V'ala mishpat asher yomer lecha, what about the second phrase? Those are things that they learned, shalom de osam min adin, ba'achas min admidos shatorin edreshes bahem, darshaning psukim. And finally, mikol hadavar asher yagidu lecha, anything that they inform you about, zo kabbalah shekiblu ish mipi ish. So it's amazing to get exposure. This does not happen very often, I don't think, in the Mishneh Torah, that we get a window into the Parshanut of the Rambam. This Pasuk, which we read, says Rambam, there's three things here, and there are three domains, and they're all included. This is the position of Rambam. And needless to say, the Chiddush here is obviously the third category, namely, even things that are absolutely a product of the Rabbanon, their enactments and preventative measures, are also covered by the Torah's commandment to heed them. From a certain point of view, you could say, ultimately, every derabbanan is covered by a deraisa. That's really what the implications of what the Rambam is saying. This position of Rambam is famously disputed by the Ramban in this final matter. The Ramban, in his critical commentary to the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvos, writes at length on this matter, and as far as the Ramban is concerned, it is only the things that the Sanhedrin say that are about dinim de araisa, Torah law itself, that's what's covered by the Torah law to listen to them. So if they tell you, give you information about a mitzvah from the Torah says, listen to them. If they darshan a pasuk with regards to din Torah, listen to them. That's covered by the Torah. But the things that the Rabbanon say, which are pure derabbanon, preventative measures and siyagim and takonos, etc., that is not covered by the Torah. It's derabbanon in inception, and it's derabbanon in nature. And it has that's its level, but it's not the araisa. Interestingly, if we would pause, and this is, of course, a major, major discussion, as we can appreciate, if we would pause at the stage, there's a lot that goes into each of the sides. But in terms of parshanut, I think we could say that looking at the psukim within the context of a parsha shir, one can understand a little bit where each side is coming from. After all, don't forget, the background to the Torah's discussion of listening to the Sanhedrin is if you have a shaila about a mitzvah. That's Pasuk Ches. We've read Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph, where the Torah says, listen to the words of the Sanhedrin. But how does it all begin? What's the context of this mitzvah? Says Pasuk Ches, ki pale mimcha davar la mishpat. What if you are uncertain about a matter of mishpat? Bein dam ledam, matters related to blood, bein din ledin, bein nega lanega. These are all d'oraisa things. Says the Torah, v'kamta v'alisa elamakam, go up and ask the Sanhedrin. So I think, again, leaving other considerations aside, if you look at the flow of the psukim, it all begins by a question about a d'oraisa issue. So when the Torah says, heed the words of the Sanhedrin, I think we can understand the Ramban's position that we're talking about d'oraisa things. The Torah didn't speak about d'rabbanan things. That's Ramban's position. On the other hand, for the Rambam has already stated the basis of his position. You have the Pasuk Yud Aleph just keeps on going. You have the Torah and the Mishpat and the Davar. So Pasuk Yud Aleph basically opens up the whole thing into every sphere that the Sanhedrin deal with. In other words, according to the Rambam, Pasuk Ches, which says you have a Shaila about a Din Torah, that might be the background to the Torah's discussion, but it doesn't fully frame the Isser that the Torah, the mitzvah that the Torah will give. Ultimately, once the question has been broached, the Torah says it is every area that the Sanhedrin are involved in, not only the Oraisa-related things, but also their rabbinic enactments that are ultimately included in that very phrase-laden Pasuk Yud Aleph. So these are the positions. And we're not going to get too invested into the discussion, but two classic points to raise, one on Ramban's behalf and one on Rambam. And I mention them because they're things with which we are familiar. So it's very interesting to see how they find their place within this discussion. Says the Ramban in his critical commentary to Rambam, I will prove to you that Dinim Durabonon are not covered by this Isser, which of course is Ramban's position, taking issue with Rambam, are not covered by this mitzvah. Why do I say that? Because doesn't everyone know, says Ramban, that Rabbanon laws are dealt with more leniently than Torah laws? And what is the classic expression or demonstration of this difference? A question of suffix. If one isn't sure whether something is prohibited, when in doubt, does one need to go l'chumra, err on the side of stringency, or can one go l'kula? In this matter, again, there's many details, but we're just mentioning the principle. In this matter, we distinguish between whether it's Torah law or rabbinic law. Suffix de oraisa, l'chumra. One needs to go l'chumra. Suffix de rabbanon. But if it's a Rabbanon law, I would say Durabbanon only, to use the phrase advisedly, it's Lakula. Says Ramban, but according to the Rambam, every rabbinic law is underwritten by a Torah law. Because as soon as the Rabbanon say, this is the halacha, the Torah says, and listen to them. So every Durabbanon is backed by a Duraisa. Which means if you're not sure whether something is Osir midrabanan, it's actually a suffix d'oraisa. Because if it is osir, the Torah backs it. There should be no such thing as a suffix d'rabanan anymore. Every d'rabanan is a d'oraisa in d'rabanan's clothing. So why do we distinguish with them and go, are able to be lenient for a d'rabanan law? That's a serious question. And the classic answer which is given, there's more than one answer, but the classic answer that's given is to be found in the writings of the Tashbats, Rabbi Shimon ben Semach, in his commentary Zohar Harakia on the mitzvahs. And the Tashbats says, it's true. In principle, as far as the Rambam is concerned, every drabbanon is actually a d'oraisa, as Rambam says, which means in a case of sofek, one should go to chumra even for drabbanon, because it's a sofek d'oraisa. It's the rabbanon themselves that stipulated that their own laws should be dealt with differently than natural Torah law. They did not avail themselves of the d'oraisa backing in a case of sofek. They stipulated, in order to distinguish their laws, which are albeit backed by the Torah, but the inception is with the rabbanon, not to be confused with natural Torah law. It's the rabbis themselves that made that distinction. If it's actual Torah law, you have to go l'chumra in the case of doubt. But with our laws, we will not insist that you go l'chumra. On the contrary, we are telling you that it's acceptable. So if the rabbanon stipulated, so there's no isser anymore. And why did they do this? Says the Ksava Kabbalah, because don't forget, this ties into a position of the Rambam elsewhere. Namely, the prohibition of Bal Tosif not to add on to the Torah. As far as the Rambam is concerned, part of the prohibition is if you would say that this is natural din Torah when it isn't, if you would take something that's osur min rabbanon and make like it's actually osur from the Torah itself asurd it, that's Bal Tosif. You've added on. Says Rambam, for example, the Torah forbids to cook meat and milk, but the Torah does not prohibit cooking poultry and milk. The rabbis did. And it's osur. But if a person would say that the Torah forbade poultry with milk, he violated Bal Tosif. Amazing. He might think he's a big tzaddik. He might think he's done a service to the Jewish people by telling them that the Torah forbade it. He's actually violated an isser called Bal Tosif. He's added onto the shape of natural Torah law. Therefore, in order to preserve very clearly the distinction between what's natural Torah law and what's drabbanon law, the rabbis themselves made this caveat that within case of suffolk, for drabbanon you go lekula. Let it be known that this is drabbanon in inception. When we insist on it, the Torah backs it, indeed. But that is the classic response to Ramban's question from suffolk d'oraisa lechumra, suffolk drabbanon lekula. But the Rambam has his own proof. And this, again, is something that we all experience on an annual basis. It's a discussion in the Gemara about Hanukkah lights. Everyone knows that just before you light your menorah, you say, Baruch Atah Hashem, Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvosav V'tzivanu Lahadlik Ner Shel Hanukkah. Amazing. We say Hashem commanded us to light the Hanukkah lights. Now, the Gemara itself asks a simple question. Did he? In other words, last we heard, Hashem's commandments are in the Torah. Hanukkah is way after the Torah. Hashem never addressed the question of Hanukkah. It's Darabanan in nature. So how can we make a bracha that Hashem commanded us to light the Hanukkah lights? It's a very important question. I mean, I'd let the person light the menorah before broaching the issue with them. But it's important to confront this. And the Gemara does. And the Gemara says, you know where Hashem commanded us to light the menorah? When he said, our pasuk, lo sasur min adover asher yagidu lecha, the Torah backs every enactment of the Rabbanan. And therefore, as Rambam himself lays it out, Hashem did not directly tell you to light the menorah, but he did command you to do so indirectly because he commanded you to listen to the rabbis who said to light the menorah. That's the pshat in the bracha. But that would seem to indicate quite clearly that the rabbis themselves, that the Torah itself also covers the prohibition of lo sasur and the mitzvahs of listening to the rabbanon, also cover the rabbinic aspects. In case you're worried that the Ramban does not have a response to this proof, he does. We're not going to go into it. But these are some of the highlights from the major, major sugya of lo sasur. The only thing that needs to be remains to be discussed, at least in terms of our own comprehensive discussion, is what type of rabbis are we talking about? Meaning, what type of chachamim? Who is included? And the background to this is that the Torah, again, when it presents this, says you shall go up to the place that Hashem has chosen. It's talking about the central location of the Sanhedrin. And then the Torah says, you need to listen to what they say. Do not swerve from what they tell you to do. And that is why the Rambam, in a number of places, always specifies that the Torah obligation to listen to the Chachamim is talking about the Beis Din HaGadol Shebirushalayim, or the Beis Din HaGadol, the Great Sanhedrin. It should be noted, and it is known, the Sefer HaChinuch, who generally follows the Rambam, often follows the Rambam. In this regard, the Sefer HaChinuch says, any Chacham, in any generation, if he's a Talmud Chacham, a Torah person, is covered by the Torah mitzvah of Lo Sosser. The Rambam does not say that. The Rambam says that it's the Beis Din HaGadol. They're the types of Chacham that we're talking about, which is very interesting. That is what the Rambam says in three places, in Sefer HaMitzvos, in Hilchos Mamrim, and also in the Mora Nevuchim. But interestingly, there is one final place where the Rambam talks about this, and he seems to expand the scope beyond the Sanhedrin. And that is in his introduction to the Yad HaChazaka, to the Mishnah Torah. And there the Rambam starts to talk about the Shas, Gemara, Talmud Bavli. The Rambam says that any halacha which is agreed upon in the Talmud Bavli is bound by the prohibition of Lo Sosser. So that's very interesting. The Talmud Bavli was sealed and written and redacted long. There's no Sanhedrin anymore. And still the Rambam says the halachas that are agreed upon in the Gemara, in the Shas, are covered by the prohibition of Lo Sosser. How can it be? They're not a Beis Din HaGadol. Says Rabbi Chonon Wasserman, in the Kuntres Divrei Sofrim, according to the Rambam, the Gemara is the Beis Din HaGadol. It is the Sanhedrin. Because the Rambam famously is of the opinion that the collective or consensus of Chachamim in any generation actually have the power of Beis Din HaGadol. The Rambam says this in his famous discussion of whether smicha can be reinstituted. Smicha, that is to say, the original smicha, capital S, the unbroken chain of transmission from Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem to Moshe, Moshe to Yeshua, until smicha was discontinued at some point in the Gemara, in the first two or three generations, and then we don't have it anymore. And if you don't have it anymore, you can never get it back because it needs an unbroken chain. But according to the Rambam, you can get it back. It can be jump-started, so to speak, because if all of the Chachamim will get together and decide that so-and-so should receive smicha, he will then have smicha, and then he can give smicha to other people. This was famously embarked upon in Sfat in the 1500s. We've discussed that on other occasions. But says Rabbi Chonon Wasserman, what do you see from this view of the Rambam? That the consensus of the Chachamim, the collective Chachamim, in any given generation, have the latent power of the Beis Din HaGadol. And therefore, it shouldn't be surprising that the Rambam says that the halacha that's agreed upon in the Shas would be covered by the mitzvahs of Lo Sosser, even though he normally says that that's only for the Beis Din HaGadol. The Shas has the power of Beis Din HaGadol for reasons that we said. So these are, as we can appreciate, these discussions are long and detailed, but again, as we say, just some of the highlights, hard to look at Parsha Shoftim, or take leave of it without having checked in with this famous discussion between Rambam and Ramban, which has ramifications and reverberations until our time with regards to Lo Sosser. Having mentioned Pasuk Ches, I came across a comment this week. It is it chills the blood. And it was said 100 years ago, but it's one of those things that could have been taken from the headlines of any day in the last 2 years and beyond. It was written for the times in which we live, and it takes us back to Pasuk Ches, and we'll read the Pasuk Perik Yud Zayin Pasuk Ches Ki Palei Mimcha Davar LaMishpat. If you are in wonder, uncertain about a matter of Mishpat, in whatever area it may be. Bein dam ledam, whether it's matters relating to blood, there's many halachas that relate to blood, tumah and tara, etc. Bein din ledin, right, different rulings, again, if it's in that area, Be'nega le'nega, we know there's different afflictions, there's saras, etc. Any of these things, divrei ruvos b'sharecha, and it leads to differing opinions in your locale. So it's a stalemate. So then you need to take recourse to the higher authority of the central Beis Din. V'kamta v'alisa el ha'mokom asher yivchar Hashem elokecha bo. That's Pasuk Ches, read and translated as straightforward as we can. Says Rav Meir Shapira, there's an underlying message here. And it's about the Jewish experience. And how does it begin? Ki palei mimcha davar lamishpat. If you find yourself in wonderment about mishpat, what is mishpat? Justice. The Jewish people are liable to find themselves absolutely confounded by the whole concept of mishpat as it applies to them and as it applies to others. And it leads to just a complete bewilderment. How so? There's different areas. Number one, what is the first area of perplexity? Bein dam ladam, between one type of blood and another. All blood should be the same. So says justice. But you might find yourselves confused when it comes to justice, because you might discover that not all blood is the same. There are distinctions made between this blood and that blood. There's distinctions made between Jewish blood and other blood. And one of them is redder than the other. And you don't know what to make of it. And you don't know who to talk to. That's number one. The blood of a Jew is a different color. Any crime or atrocity perpetrated against them doesn't register on the blood meter. Somehow it's transparent. Number two, bein din ledin. What are the rules? What are the laws? What's expected of any group? The answer is, it depends. Who are you? Are you a Jewish group? Are you a Jewish country? Or are you other? Because the rules could be different. And that's just how it is. How are you meant to engage with the enemy? How many precautions are you meant to take? How much are you expected to take care of them more than they even take care of themselves? What's considered acceptable? The answer is, before we answer that question, who are we talking about? You, the Jewish people, or someone else? Because you have to understand there's a different answer for depending. In din le din. What's the din? Depends who you are. One din for them, one din for us. Be nega la nega. What is a nega? A flaw. What constitutes a flaw? Depends who you are. Our nega is not their nega. Activities that our enemies are involved in are nega with a capital N. But they're all forgiven. The Jewish people are incapable of doing the right thing. Whatever they do is a nega. Their enemies are incapable of doing the wrong thing. And they're trying. It's not helping them. They can do no wrong. The laws of what constitutes a nega are different. This is our situation. And that's how Rav Meir Shapira said it, which means there was enough experience already in his time. And this is a little 100 years ago, but of course, it's almost a commentary on us. And that's ki palei mimcha. You just find yourself flummoxed, bewildered. You can't work it out. And no one even needs to explain it to you. That's not part of their achrayas. Dumb the dumb. Explain to me how groups that advocate to protect whoever they are, unless they're Jews, because their blood is different, and you have this Palgin and Dibura, you have this this absolute dichotomy, Ben Din Ladin, Ben Nega La Nega. Is there any way to explain it? Not really. But there is a certain bit of soul searching. And we're reminded of this often, but we can't be reminded of it too often. What can we do? Are you going to convince the nations of the world on whatever forums or platforms? Possibly, but unlikely. One shouldn't abdicate and completely give up. But where does it begin? What is the next pasuk? What is the next words in the pasuk? Divrei rivos b'sharecha. There are disputes in your own gates. And that doesn't make for a good situation. And that can often bring about a different climate when the Jewish people are together with themselves. Everything changes, even the way the nations of the world look at them. If the Jewish people have divrei rivos b'sharecha, and they've got their own disputes going on, they might find themselves facing other disputes, and disputes that they can't win. So if ever there is a call for repair in the realm of divrei rivos b'sharecha, that's the answer that the Torah presents. I mean, it is noted that the Torah goes on to say, "V'kamta v'alisa el amoka mashir shchar Hashem elokecha." Go up to the place that Hashem has chosen. That's also recommended. Our problems don't end there, but it is there that our problems will end, as we know. So these are impossible, I think, to overstate the profundity of this comment of Rabbi Meir Shapira. Many things that people are thinking, if they would only express them in Torah terms, they would literally be reading this pasuk. We can't solve the world's problems, but if we start with our own problems, it's a good step in the right direction. Divrei rivos b'sharecha, so says the Torah. Let's move on a little further in the parsha to the mitzvah of Melech, and that is still in Perek Yud Zayin. It's Sheni. Yes, and of course the pasuk begins Pasuk Yud Dalek Kisavo La Aretz Asher Hashem Lokecha Nosein Lach V'Yushtav Yoshav Taba. You'll settle there. V'Amato Asim Alei Melech, and you'll say, "I'd like a king." And there is a famous shaila as to whether v'omarta is something that you should say. Meaning, is this a mitzvah to say this? Is it a mitzvah to want a king and then appoint a king? Or is it circumstantial, situational? If you say it, here's the way to do it. That's a famous machlokas actually in the Sifrei. But regardless, Shem Tosim Alecha Melech, it's your place. However, even if there is a discussion as to whether there's a mitzvah to appoint a king, it's clear that the Torah is not discouraging it. The Rambam, by the way, based on the Gemara, includes appointing a king in one of the 613 mitzvahs. The Amarta is, say it. It's as it says in Sanhedrin, one of the three mitzvahs that we were commanded to do after entering the land of Israel, the first is to appoint a king. The Gemara calls it a mitzvah. But as we said, even if it's not a mitzvah, but the Torah is clearly condoning it, it's not in any way disparaging or discouraging. But that leads us to the famous question in Sefer Shmuel. When the people told Shmuel that they wanted a king, and Shmuel begins to castigate them and rebuke them, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Shmuel, "Don't take it personally. It's not you they detest, it's me." It was considered to be ill-advised for the people to ask for a king. And the question is why? The Torah says it's okay. And this is the famous question which has occupied our sources from the beginning, from Chazal. And the Sifrei in our Parsha and the Tosefta in Sanhedrin both say the same thing. There is a mitzvah. At least there are opinions that there is a mitzvah to ask for a king. The problem with the people at the time of Shmuel is that they asked for the king too early. It was a premature request. That's why it was condemned. Hikdimu lish'ol. They asked too early. And the question, of course, that we need to try and understand is, too early for what? Why is it too early? And they'd been in the land for a good while. And when is the right time? And how do we know? What does it mean to be too early? And they've been in the land for over 300 years. Why is that too early? And many Mefarshim explain, each one in their own way, what it means that it was too early. But I came across a wonderful explanation in the Sefer Ben Melech of Reb Leib Mintzberg. Because it cuts to the core not only of what it means to be a king, but what it means to be the Jewish people. We call the Jewish people Am Hashem. We are Hashem's people. What exactly does that mean? I mean, it means many things. We're the bearers of his message and keepers of his Torah. It means many things. But on a fundamental level, it means more than that. The Pasuk says in Yeshaya, Hashem says concerning the Jewish people, Am zu yotzarti li tehilasi yedabeva. I formed this nation, I formed and fashioned this nation for me. Talking about the Jewish people. Every nation has been created by Hashem, but he has fashioned the Jewish people. There's a certain yetzira, formation, that Hashem says, I made the Jewish people in what they are. And part of what that means is that the history of the Jewish people can be divided into two significant eras. Number one, the era of the formation of the people, the formation and establishment of the people, and then the ongoing existence and activity of the people. But the formation stage is done by Hashem. As he says, Am zu yotzarti li. Where do we see this most dramatically? How did we begin as a nation? We actually began almost at a point of non-existence. We did not have any independence or any control, any autonomy, any sway over our destiny. We're a nation of slaves. And Hashem took us out, Be'osos uvemosim, with miracles. And what does that mean? It means that the emergence of the Jewish people as a nation takes place from almost zero until they're where they became, all happened through Hashem. Am zu yotzarti li. He is forming and fashioning the Jewish people. And this continued. It continued in the sense that we continue to be accompanied by miracles. We spend 40 years in the wilderness, that the Jewish people are still being formed, and therefore Hashem is directly providing for them in that way. And even the entry into the land of Israel, which is still establishing the Jewish people, because when are the Jewish people fully established? When they're at peace in their own country, which is the land of Israel. So as long as they're on the way to doing that, they're still being established. And that's why the conquest of the land of Israel in the days of Yeshua, etc., was also accompanied by miracles. Direct, overt, divine intervention. The walls of Jericho and the sun standing still and so on. Because the Jewish people are still being formed. And as long as they're being formed, so then it's Hashem who is directly above them. The time has not yet come to talk about a king, because a king is a more temporal leader. His time will come, but his time will come when the Jewish people have been formed by Hashem. Hashem will then hand them over to his representative, who's called a king. People need a king. But this is why, says Ben Melech, when you look at the early leaders of the Jewish people, they're not kings in the classic sense of the word. Our first leader is Moshe Rabbeinu. It's true, Moshe has halachically the status of a king, but we don't think of Moshe as a king when we think of him leading the Jewish people. He is he's the Navi. Lo kam Yisrael, Navi od Kamoshe. He is the Navi. But the king doesn't have to be a prophet. And in fact, in later generations, the king would have a prophet that he would consult with, but there's no requirement whatsoever that the king be a prophet. They're two different domains. But the early leader of the first leader of the Jewish people was a Navi, because he is directly representing Hashem in terms of the divine flow, because the Jewish people are still being formed. And the same is true for Yeshua. And Yeshua is in many respects a reflection of Moshe, Pnei Moshe, Kepnei Chama, Kepnei Yeshua, Kepnei Levona. Yeshua is also a Navi. And he brings the Jewish people in. He also has the status of a king, as the Rambam says, but we don't talk about him as a king. He's a Navi more than anything else. Hashem will communicate directly with Yeshua. And they're accompanied by miracles, because we're still in the case of Yetzira. So the leaders of the Jewish people, they need to be much more in or aligned with an expression of Hashem's will as being communicated through them as Nevi'im. And so it is with the Shoftim, each one in their own way. The Pasuk will always say, Vatihi alav Ruach Hashem, Yad Hashem, until you get to Shmuel himself. And Shmuel is back again a Navi, and he's the leader. And we're very close now. The Jewish people are very close to finishing the conquest of the land of Israel and fully establishing themselves. But they should have waited a little bit more. In other words, this is the understanding of the statement, the Sifrei Netosefta, that we ask too early. Why is it too early? How can that be framed or understood? And when is it the right time? The answer is it's too early when you're still being formed. As long as you're still in the process of conquering the nations of the land and establishing yourselves there, you're still being formed. It's too early for a king. And that's why Shmuel is upset when they ask for a king. And Hashem says, it's not you they detest, it's me, which is a very, very strong condemnation. But what it means in our understanding is that the Jewish people were looking to move away a little bit. They wanted to consider themselves fully formed just a little bit before they really were those years. In time it would come. When David HaMelech comes on the scene and Hashem tells Shmuel, I want you to anoint David. The time has come for the Jewish people to have a king. They're basically on the cusp of being fully established, and David can already be a king. Shaul, those 2.5 years are difficult, because we tried to almost like bring in Shabbos early. We tried to see ourselves as fully established before the time. And that's where the condemnation came. So it's very interesting to consider what are the implications of, was there fallout? Were there consequences from the fact that we'd asked for a king just that number of years before Hashem judged that we really were ready? In the end, we got one. It didn't last very long. Because the asking for a king was, in a sense, ill-advised, it was also ill-fated to a large degree for those couple of years. It's interesting to consider whether there are any lasting reverberations of having asked for too early, or do we say that was an unfortunate situation, but once David HaMelech has come on the scene, things proceed as usual, as if we hadn't asked before then. That is worth pondering for sure. But this is the wonderful analysis of the Ben Melech. Again, to take a phrase which really needs to be locked down when the Sifrei says it was too early. How can one frame the question of whether it's early or the right time, and what makes for the right time? This is his explanation based on that pasuk, Amzu Yatzartili, and that remains an enduring message for the Jewish people. Jewish people are people that were formed directly by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Tilasi Yisapir. I'd like to, just for the final few moments, move to the end of the parsha, which is the famous section of Egla Arucha. And as we know, it's very many details. It's an unusual mitzvah in terms of it's very, very specific. What should happen if a person has been found, he's been killed, and no one knows who did it, and they bring this Egla, this calf, and they decapitate it, and there's proclamations, and everyone is there, and it's, we've spoken about the mitzvah itself in previous years. But one of the famous psukim that are discussed is Maftir, actually, Perik Kaf Aleph Pasuk Zayin. It's really three psukim from the end. So the Bezdin comes down and they say, V'anu v'amru yadeinu lo shafchu es hadam hazeh. We didn't spill this blood. V'einei lo ra, we didn't see. And of course, the Gemara cited by Rashi here is kind of aghast by the fact that the Sanhedrin should need to clear themselves of suspicion that they shed his blood. No one's suspecting them of that. But why do they need to say that it didn't happen? And that's why the Gemara famously says, and Rashi cites it, no one is ever thinking that they did. But what they're saying is, we're also in the clear in that there weren't any measures that we could have taken to protect him that we didn't take. And famously, as it says, we didn't just let him go. We didn't let him go without accompaniment and without food and drink, etc. He didn't just leave by himself. Lepatarnuhu below alechem umay. So it sounds like, had the Sanhedrin let him go and not accompanied him, or had representatives of the community or people from the community just let him go and not given him anything and not accompanied him, that would be called shvichus damim. It's like they somehow made him more vulnerable. And the question is how. So I heard from my father Zatzal many years ago that it could be down to the mood of the person, as if to say, when a person is in good spirits, so then they can take care of themselves much better than if they're dejected. Imagine a person who leaves, no one notices, and no one cares about them, and no one gave them anything, and no one accompanies them. That's almost like an accident-prone person. I mean, that's someone who's, they look like an easy target, and maybe they are. And maybe a bit of the oomph has kind of gone out of them. And maybe they could have defended themselves better had they been in better spirits. That's I recall my father saying many years ago. The Maharal in the Chiddushi HaGodos to Masechah Sota, interestingly, it's not in the Gur Aryeh to Rashi here, but in the Chiddushi HaGodos to Masechah Sota, he says something which, again, very, very thought-provoking. And that is, the Rabbim always have more koach than the Yachid. We talk about the merit of the Rabbim, the power of the Rabbim. And of course, that's a power that accrues to every member of the Rabbim. Now, you're not always together with everyone else in the community. You might need to go somewhere. So the question is, when you leave, do you leave? And if you're not with them geographically at this stage, are you still part of them? The answer is, it depends. Have they made you part of them? Did they accompany you? Did they give you something? Are you still connected with them? You might be physically and geographically in one place and them in somewhere else, but if you're connected to them, you still have the power of the tzibur. You partake of that power. And that could be something that could protect you. And that is what the members of the Sanhedrin are saying. We didn't just let him go. We didn't just leave him to be by himself. When he left as part of us and remains that way, which means if something happened, but the Sanhedrin can't be indicted. And this is now a fascinating idea whereby your location, that's not the final word as to whether you're part of the community, as to whether you're part of the tzibur. It's whether you're connected to the tzibur, whether they're connected to you and whether you're connected to them. And I'm mindful of a story, and especially as we come close to days where we want to be part of the tzibur, we want to get through the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur as part of the tzibur. What does it mean to be as part of the tzibur? The Shem Yishmuel famously says, based on the Gemara, that the Gemara says if there's a shipwreck and people start davening, that prayer is not called communal prayer. It's called yachid, even if there's 100 people on the boat, because it's understood that each person is thinking about themselves. And therefore, so that's not a community of 100 people. That's 100 individuals. So geography is not enough. There was a time as the Mir Yeshiva was establishing itself here in Yerushalayim, this would be in the 50s, and the Bochum, who used to get certain stipend and funds, they came to the Rosh Yeshiva, then Reb Lezer Yehuda Finkel, and they asked if there was more money available, because they just felt that they needed like a little bit more for basic expenses, not luxuries, but they asked for a raise, so to speak. And is there more money? Does the yeshiva have more money? And Reb Lezer Yehuda said to them, the yeshiva does have more money, but I can't give it to you because the yeshiva has other projects and it's needed for those things. So I'm sorry, but that's how it is for now. So one of the Bochrim kept going and said, actually, the Rosh Yeshiva should know that halachically he is bound to give us the money. He's required to give us the money. Why? Because the Rosh Yeshiva is a bigger Talmud Chacham than us. But there's 50 of us and there's only one of the Rosh Yeshiva. So the halacha states you always follow the majority. So we're the majority. So the halacha requires the Rosh Yeshiva to give us the money. I don't know if you could get away with saying that to a Rosh Yeshiva nowadays, but these are back in the day when the Bochum were, and both Rosh Yeshiva, they're all Litvak, so this was acceptable. So there, that's the charge. The Bachrim are the Rabbim. So is the Rosh Hashiva bound to give them the money? Reb Lezer Yehuda said to them, I have to tell you, it's not true. And I'll tell you why. Each of you, and again, legitimately, each of you wants more money. But I put it to you, there's 50 of you. But when each of you is asking, they're asking for themselves. That makes you 50 yechidim. I'm only one person, but I'm keeping the money for the whole yeshiva. And because I'm keeping the money for the whole yeshiva, so that makes me the rabbin, and the halacha is like me. And it's such an insight as to what it means to be part of a community and to be part of the... It means to have the interests of the community at heart, to have their well-being at heart. What better way to echo the sentiment of Rav Meir Shapira, Divrei Ribus v'Sharecha, what better way to enter these days than in that way? As if to say, connected to the tzibur, to think outside of ourselves as we do in the days coming. We should want what's best for ourselves, we should want for what's best for our community and for the entire Jewish people. They should all have a kasiv chasima tova, which is things that we start to already think about at this time, and we should soon witness for the entire Jewish people, every part of that people, basiras tovos, yeshuas v'nechamos.